You wanna give love to the city, that's a fact. But you're gonna need help if you wanna make an impact.
Well endowed,
you want to be
well endowed
with the Edmonton community.
Things really happen when you find that you're well endowed.
Hi everyone, welcome to the Well Endowed podcast brought to you by Edmonton Community Foundation. We bring you community discourse about amazing organizations and people who come together to make Edmonton strong. I'm Elizabeth Bonkink.
And I'm Andrew Paul. We've got a very special announcement to share at the end of our show, so be sure to stay tuned and listen for it at the end of our news segment.
Just to give a hint, it has to do with George Takei and getting some VIP treatment. Trust us, you don't want to miss this.
Okay, let's dive in. On this month's episode, Jazz Pander reveals everything you ever wanted to know about the Seek Turban with the Turban A event. We chat with Karen Unland about the landscape of podcasting in Edmonton, and we find out more about her new project, the Alberta Podcast Network. And we'll head to the zoo, where we'll catch up with a handful of ECF donors and partners. But first, we sit down with John Hall to remember his wife, Gail Hall, and her dedication to uplifting Edmonton's community.
Gail Hall was truly a pillar of her community. Whether it was whisking local foodies across the globe on culinary tours or her work teaching low-income families to cook, Gail's roots and generosity ran deep in this city. Last fall, Gail passed away after living with breast cancer for 8 years. To honor Gail's legacy, the Chef Gail Fund was created at Edmonton Community Foundation to help continue her passions for helping those in need. Here's Andrew's conversation with Gail's husband, John, about her life, love of food, and how she'll continue impacting our city with her infectious generosity.
Welcome to the Well Endowed podcast, John. How's it going today?
It's going very well, thank you.
Excellent. I just have to give a little bit of a disclosure here. I've met Gail through Theatre Network, and she was actually my Next Fest mom in 2013 when I screened my very first short film festival. And Next Fest had this Adopt an Artist program, which is a way to support the festival. And it was just an absolutely fantastic experience getting to meet Gail, and I was very generous of her to sponsor me. And people know Gail through her food work, primarily, I would think. But she was also involved in the community in so many other ways, including theater.
Well, you just told me a story I didn't know anything about. So it's pretty amazing. She lived an independent life. We lived independently, but together. And she did her own thing. She was an entrepreneur and an inspiration. And she stepped out into the world in many different ways. Theater was one. She loved theater. She loved Theater Network. And she loved being on the board. She also served on the Chamber Board and the board for Women of Vision and several other organizations. So she was very involved in the community.
So why was being involved in the community important to Gail?
I think she was just a really outgoing person. When she walked down the street, she would say hello to everybody she passed. She was just that sort of outgoing community-minded person that just wanted to be out there in the community. And she lived a boring life at home.
It's spring now, and Gail is all about fresh ingredients. So what kind of dishes would she be cooking this time of year?
Food for Gail was always seasonal, so she would be waiting anxiously for the first asparagus to be coming into the market, which comes in early June. She would be serving the last of the winter vegetables, turnips and parsnips and potatoes and last year's apples and working through last year's crop.
So can you walk us maybe through a meal prep for maybe a dinner on a typical Saturday when the market is open?
Well, Gail instituted farmers market cooking classes with Judy Schultz. The two of them got together and decided that this might be a thing they could do, and they experimented with it, and it obviously worked out. So she would gather up by the Sobey stores on Jasper Avenue with a group of 8 or 10 people, and they would walk through the market, and she would introduce them to the cheesemaker and the grocer and the people that were growing fresh vegetables and the people who are providing organic beef, introduce them and get the vendor to talk about their product, which they were always eager to do. And then people would go up to the loft on 104th Street and sit around the table, and she would start serving them a Canadian wine, usually a bright, sparkling white wine, and people would start talking. She would often ask them for their first food experience, their oldest food memory, and people just started talking. After about 20 minutes or an hour, I'd prompt her to start cooking. And so she would bring people up and they would start preparing the food. And everybody at those market classes, it was hands-on. They did the work. She guided them, but she did the work. And it could be anything from a buffalo dish to a stew or just simply soups and salads. And she would walk them all through. And at the end of the cooking portion, at which we'd served another three or four different kinds of Canadian wines, everyone would sit down at the round table, and have a delightful dinner, a three-course dinner, served on her mother's silverware and elegantly presented. And then people would still sit around afterwards and talk about food and what they'd experienced. It was always a great experience. People went home thrilled every time.
My wife and I like to cook at the end of the day, and she's definitely like the chef, the two of us, and I'm really good at chopping veg. I was just sort of wondering what your dynamic with Gail in the kitchen was.
Well, I tried cooking for Gail early on, and she discovered that that maybe was not the best way to go. So I got relegated to the back of the kitchen where the sink is. And so I was often just washing the dishes and supporting her in that way. Or if somebody came up with a question that we needed to research, I would dash off and look it up on the internet or drag it out of a book or something and bring it back to the class. Gail and I visited 30 countries on our culinary tour. So it was almost like we were on different tours because she would work the front of the crowd and I was often working the back of the crowd. And I was looking for different things than she was. I could often fill in details of a tour that she may not have picked up on or something that maybe I had noticed. I'm really interested in the production side of wine rather than the tasting side of wine. So when we're talking about a particular wine, perhaps I could talk about the trellising or the pumping over techniques or something like that that Gail wasn't particularly interested in. She was interested in the taste notes and she could describe those eloquently. So sort of filling in around the edges of her food knowledge and just making sure that we tried to have a well-rounded experience.
When did things really start rolling for Gail on the food front?
Gail said, well, how do I become a caterer? I said, well, as far as I know, there are no job requirements. So you print up a business card, this is Gail Hall Caterer, and start spreading the word. So her first order was a cake in the shape of a house for a mortgage burning for a friend of ours. And from there, she moved on to doing cooking in people's homes and going out and doing dinner parties. And then after a couple of months, it was getting busier and busier. So we went looking for a professional kitchen that she could work in. And we found a kitchen that had been developed by Riddle's Chocolate. Neither of us really knew what we were doing in real estate at the time. And the landlord finally agreed to 19 months, which took us through that Christmas and the following Christmas. And if we couldn't make it through those two harvest seasons, then we knew it wasn't going to go. But it did. Eventually, we got to the point where we needed to expand again, and Gail went looking for a building and found the building on 107th Avenue and 109th Street. And then the World Trade Towers got hit, and the whole food world stopped. Restaurant receipts across the country, across North America, dropped. Jasper Park Lodge almost closed. The Royal York was at 10% capacity. So it became more and more difficult as people started to cocoon for the company to continue. So eventually Gail shut it down. She had 100 staff at that point. And so she shut it down and basically went into hibernation for a year.
When did she decide to pursue her Red Seal certification?
Well, Gail was self-trained. Her brother owned the restaurant. Her father owned a restaurant. Her other brother was in the food business off and on. So she had a long background, family background in food. And she'd been cooking for her family since she was 10 or 11. So she knew a lot about food and she had an innate ability. And for our first anniversary, I sent her off to Vancouver to a professional cooking school for a week as a first anniversary present. Never start with a big present. Start small and work up because it's really hard to top it on the second year. But she was really quite excited about that. So through her busy career, she just kept building accolades. But finally, towards the end, she thought, I really should qualify. So she challenged the Red Seal exam, which is rarely done. There's only been a couple of examples of that. And she got letters from the chefs that she'd worked with and qualified. She went through an extensive interview and then finally wrote the exam. And that was only 3 or 4 years ago. So it was quite late in her career, but it was probably her proudest achievement.
Food education was also very important to Gail. And she was doing some work at the Bissell Center, I believe, teaching single mothers how to cook.
Yeah.
Can you maybe tell us a little bit about that side of things?
Well, Gail taught with Metro, the public school board extension department for over 25 years. So she was always in the catalog, always doing two or three or four courses a year. She ran cooking classes both at Gourmet Goodies and in our loft and loved doing that. She was the CBC commentator for 5 years and did television right up to the end. She was on all three television channels once a month, and they all professed that she was their favorite guest because it was simple. It wasn't Food Channel complicated. It wasn't a competition. It was take a potato, cut it up this way, you know, prepare it this way, and you could do it at home. So she was always educating that way. And part of the reason we went on so many culinary tours was so that she could learn these techniques firsthand from the people that had originated them. And so she would go on television and say, we're going to New Zealand, and this is what we expect to see. And she would talk about New Zealand. And then we'd go to New Zealand, and she'd come back, and she'd do the recipes. And she would talk about the dairy, and she would talk about the experience and show slides. So it was always very interesting. And then she would reach out into the community as well, like the Bissell Center, like you suggested, teaching simple food techniques to new mothers who realized that they could buy a dessert at the store for $15, but they can make four times that if they bought the ingredients and did it themselves. Just teaching them to use the stoves and pots that they already had in their kitchen. And then last summer, she worked with the university at the Change Adventure Camp. And that was a real experience for her. She would start off with the kids in the morning, and they would make their own lunches. And then that would be packed away. And then they would go off and do activities all day. And then at noon, they would come back and eat their lunches. So the kids learned that they could do their own food. And as a result of that, these kids that had never been in a kitchen before, never handled a knife, didn't know what a tomato looked like unsliced, were suddenly going home and making their own lunches, going shopping with their parents, telling their parents about the nutritional value of various foods, and taking it home, you know, and showing an interest in food that they hadn't shown before the summer. So that was a great experience for her. And that will be continued this summer. There were two camps last summer, and I think there'll be eight this year.
Can we chat a little bit about the Chef Gail Fund?
Sure.
How did you hear about the Community Foundation and its approach to endowments?
Well, I've been in community economic development for years. I've worked on boards with Martin Garber Conrad and, worked with REACH and Homeward Trust. So, you know, the Community Foundation is just part of the background, I guess, of what I knew. And so when the community demanded that we do something to preserve Gail's legacy, it was logical that we would go to the foundation. I had some advisors around me who said that they'd done things with the foundation before. And so I reached out, and Noel Xavier hooked up with me, and he walked me through the process. And it's been really quite amazing. You guys do all the heavy work, the heavy lifting and the paperwork. And I've just got to keep pumping ideas in. And it's worked out really well. I'm really quite happy. In the first 6 months, we raised $20,000, and the fund will continue in perpetuity. And I'm really pleased about that.
Yeah. So what are you hoping to support with the fund?
Well, things that Gail would have been interested in. So good nutrition, healthy eating, young chefs. Those are things that she loved. And so programs like the Bissell Center or the Change Camp or the Nate food program, somewhere where people are learning to cook, will be supported. But that will change from year to year, depending on what the advisory committee comes up with. We won't have a lot of money to give away in the first couple of years, but I'm hoping it'll grow and become a substantial fund.
A very sincere thank you to John Hall for sharing Gail's story. John is heading off on a Cross Canada trip with the incredible goal of visiting 150 communities for Canada 150, and we wish him all the best. If you'd like to learn more about the Chef Gail Fund, you can read more about it in our summer issue of Legacy in Action magazine. Please visit our website for the link.
Back in September of 2016, a number of disturbing posters targeting people who wear turbans was found at the University of Alberta. But instead of responding with outrage, the Sikh Student Association used it as an opportunity to educate. They organized a turban tying event called Turban A, where anyone can come and ask questions and see what it's like to wear a turban. It was such a success that Turban A will now be part of the Events for Canada 150, taking place on July 1st. Jazz Pander joined me to share more about this event. Can you tell me about Turban A?
So Turban A began with the idea of demystifying the turban and creating space for people to ask questions they've always wanted to ask but have felt uncomfortable to ask. The turban is a religious tenet of faith. It's not a symbol. Because of that, you know, sometimes people are a little hesitant about maybe offending somebody or hurting somebody's feelings when they want to ask questions. Mm-hmm. And they might have a lot of questions, which is completely fine. And we just want to create a space where people can come, get their turban tied, ask all the questions they want. Because we believe that if you want to educate somebody on it, you got to make a more warm and welcoming atmosphere for it. And so people can come and get their turbine tied and ask all the questions they want and have some food while they're there.
That's fantastic. I know many Canadians are very interested in other cultures, but they're afraid of interfering or stepping on toes or not knowing the right thing to do to get to that point where they can get their questions answered. Can you tell me what the significance of the turban is?
So the significance of this turban is it's a tenet of faith in the Sikh faith. Sikhs have been in Canada since around the turn of the 20th century. So we've had a long and storied past here. We've four Sikh cabinet ministers. We've served prominently in armies across the world. So the turban is the main misconception you get, it's not a hat. It's something that you get on every day and you treat it with respect. And it's almost like it's an extension of your body, essentially. So you get on every day and you tie it. It's worn at all times, indoor and outdoors, by observant Sikhs. A lot of questions you get is like, do little kids wear them? No, we're not going to put a big turban on a little kid. There's something called a patka, which is just a cloth that you tie around your head. And you little kids can wear that. You know, when you get older, kind of you figure out your style, then you start tying your turban, which is another question that we always get is there any sort of style? There's different varying styles. It's whatever you feel fits your personality or whatever you feel is that you want to tie. There's no significance of the color. If I'm wearing a yellow shirt and I want to wear a yellow turban, I can do that. If I want to wear a white one every day, I can do that.
People often think color has symbolism, but it's really great when it just matches my outfit.
Yeah, it's that simple. And so at the university earlier this year, there was a bit of an incident where somebody put up some xenophobic and racist posters. So we were doing the event there at the university as well. And that's the first Turban A we did in Edmonton. There's also Turban A's happening in Abbotsford in Ottawa. And this started in Calgary, actually, a couple of years ago on Canada Day. And it was a massive success there. So we at the World Sikh Organization, we decided that we want to start doing this across the country because it was such a great event to do. Mayor Nenshi even came out, got a purple turban tied, I believe, as well.
Yeah, I think purple's one of his favorite colors.
Yes. So you can come there and it takes 10 minutes to tie a turban. While you're there, you can ask all the questions you want. We're going to have a lot of volunteers. I'll be happy to answer anything for you. And if you want, you can even take it home as a souvenir. We want to create that education opportunity because especially what's happened at the university and especially what's happening lately in the news and everything that's going on, if you want to combat the atmosphere that's been going around with a lot of xenophobia and stuff like that, you got to create education. And this is a great education opportunity.
Is there a reason why the turban is worn?
It's essential to your identity if you're a practicing Sikh. You don't take it off. It's part of our five tenets. If you are a baptized and fully practicing Sikh, it not only serves as a spiritual function, there's a Sikh belief about gender equality and everybody being one. There's no difference. We are all the same people. And so the turban kind of signifies that. So it's a belief in gender equality, the humility of it, and it shows the sacrifice of those who have come before you and just to show your reverence and supremacy of God. So there's a practical functioning that keeps your head covered, but because if you're a baptized Sikh, you have uncut hair. So it serves as that practical function as well, but it's showing just your reverence and respect towards God and others.
Do women wear turbans?
Yes, they do. Everybody can wear a turban.
And that's hopefully what you're going to get across is that anyone can wear one.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like I've said the word baptized, like you don't exactly have to be baptized. That's why like if whoever wants to come, you come, get your turban tied, ask all the questions you want.
Let's talk about some of the questions that you've had. What are some of the sillier questions that you've had about your turban?
There are no silly questions. Any question you want. Some of the main questions we get is, again, does the color mean anything? How heavy is it? Do you take it off at night? You know, one person came up and was like, my friend always wears a blue turban. And then his friend was there and we asked him, and he's like, my favorite color is blue. That's why I always wear a blue turban. So as simple as that. Do kids wear them? Do you take it off at night? How heavy is it is one that we've gotten.
Is it hot?
Yeah, is it hot? Exactly. That's another one. I was just about to say that. What kind of fabric is this? Do you tie this every day? And those are all the questions I ask. You tie it every day. And like, it takes you 10 minutes to tie it there. And if you do it every day, like, my dad can tie his in like 3 minutes flat.
Yeah. So yeah, I was going to say 10 minutes seems like a long time. I'm not even sure I spend that much time on my hair. So it is a daily thing that you do.
Yeah, exactly. It's exactly like that. You get up, the cloth of the turban is treated with utmost respect. You tie it on in the morning, then you come home and then you can untie it or you can just take it off. But it's not a hat. It's not something that you put on and take off, put on and take off. You tie it with respect and then you untie it with respect.
So it's part of getting dressed.
It's a part of the Sikh identity. So for a Sikh, if you're getting up in the morning and getting dressed, putting your turban on is a part of that day.
Where would you get your fabric and that kind of thing? Is this something that's readily found in Canada now?
Yeah, you can go to any like South Asian or Punjabi store. And if you say, I need some turban material, they'll point you in the right direction.
That's perfect.
And the variety and the colors, again, all that.
I guess this is happening on Canada Day, correct?
Yes, this is happening on Canada Day. We're finalizing our locations. I don't want to say anything specifically, but you can check out the World Psych Organization on social media. We'll let people know where we are once you get it finalized. We'll be there basically all day. It's Canada Day. So we'll have a little stall or a tent set up, and we'll be tying the turbines. You can come ask all the questions you want to ask, and we'll have some food there as well.
And what kind of food you can have?
I'm working on some delicious Punjabi food.
Oh, that sounds good in itself. Yeah, I think there's a lot of things planned throughout the city this year. There's lots of opportunity to commingle with other Canadians and learn lots about other cultures. So it's a great time to be able to learn more about each other and be more Canadian. Thanks very much to Jazz Pander for taking time to speak with us. Jazz is still finalizing the location of Turbine A for Canada Day, so check in with the World Seek organization at worldseek.org for event details. You can also follow them on Twitter and Facebook at worldseek.org. Are you planning to go, Andrew?
Oh yeah, you bet. Put me down for a green turban.
I think I'm more of a yellow kind of gal, but it's definitely a great opportunity to learn more about the Sikh faith. What do we have next?
Well, I'm pretty excited about our next guest. Karen Unlin has become a galvanizing force in Edmonton's journalism community. She has spent many years working in media and is leading the charge to create new, sustainable models of journalism as the industry continues to face mounting challenges. We highly recommend checking out her membership-driven online journalism platform, Taproot Edmonton. Taproot focuses on local journalism with stories that are cultivated by the curiosity of its members. We'll have a link on our website, but today we're focusing on podcasts. Through her Seen and Heard blog and podcast, Karen has created a place where we can find a huge variety of local media. And now, she's taking things to the next level with the Alberta Podcast Network. Karen joined me to talk about the journalistic landscape of Edmonton and how her forthcoming network fits into Alberta's media ecosystem.
Welcome to the Well Endowed Podcast, Karen. How's it going today?
It's going great. I'm happy to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. And I don't know if you remember this, but back in 2007 or 2008, you were actually a guest instructor of mine in the McEwen Journalism Program.
I was.
Yes, you were. And I believe at that time you were working for the Edmonton Journal. And I was actually hoping that maybe we can go back to about 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you could tell us a little bit about what you were doing in the media and what the media landscape in Edmonton was looking like back then.
Sure. So in 2007, that's the year that I became the editor in charge of EdmontonJournal.com, so the Edmonton Journal's website. And that website had existed for a while, but kind of as an afterthought. 2007 is when they started to get a little bit more serious about it and put like an editor in charge of it and had that editor, me, go to the news meetings and actually be really integrated into the discussion about the news agenda and what we were going to put where. It still, though, was kind of, well, we're a newspaper and we also have a website. So I spent the next 4 years in that position kind of trying to help change the culture of the newsroom into a more digital-first place.
Yeah, and I think it's safe to say that particularly the print media was caught on its heels with sort of the marauding new age of the internet coming in. Have newspapers gotten better at the digital side of things, or is it going to be just too late for them to really bounce back?
So I think that newspaper newsrooms are doing some of the best journalism ever thanks to the internet. So I think the internet made journalism deeper and more connected and more accountable, and like all kinds of things have benefited the kind of reporting work that people are able to do because of the internet. What the internet also did, though, was wreck the business model. And that part is not getting fixed very fast.
So you're talking about how the internet sort of killed the business model of the traditional newspaper. I think now more than ever, it's imperative for people to start finding new models. And it seems to me like you have a very keen interest on being sort of on the forefront, at least in the Edmonton scene, on finding those new models. Can you tell us about the Alberta Podcast Network?
So I'll tell you the story of how that started. In the summer of 2015, I got an opportunity to go and workshop an entrepreneurial journalism idea through a program that was hosted at the Townite Center for Entrepreneurial Journalism in New York. So I, at that time, was paying a lot of attention to podcasts and noticing a growing number of local podcasts and knowing that, especially the ones that were basically of interest to people in Edmonton, there was going to be really hard for them to make any money. And if you make money, you're more likely to keep doing something. So I started thinking about how we could create some kind of way for those creators to at least get some money so they could keep doing what they were doing, because that to me was part of the local media landscape that we needed to build up and replace, or one of the thousand flowers that's going to have to bloom in what's happening next. And then towards the end of that year, I got a chance to grab the ear of some influential people at ATB and started the process of talking to them about underwriting this podcast network idea that I had. And then we just kept going, and incredibly and happily and wonderfully, they said yes this spring. And so now Alberta Podcast Network is going to live.
So how is the network going to sort of operate? How many shows are you hoping to be able to bring under your umbrella?
So we're going to start small because I'm building the machine from the ground up. We're going to start with 10 to launch and kind of go 10 per quarter for the first year. So I think I'd love to have a 200 podcast network. There's enough in Alberta.
Yeah. So maybe we can talk a little bit about Alberta's podcast scene. How would you describe it?
It's, to me, like bubbling. It's vibrant, and new ones keep shooting up every day. I cannot keep up. There's an extreme range of like different of diversity and different voices, different formats. There's like niche on top of niche. Like you can't even believe that that's a niche, and so those are some of the ones that are the most popular. It's just so exciting to hear all these voices and see this new group of people covering little parts of our city or little parts of the world from here.
Thanks very much to Karen Unland. We're definitely looking forward to watching as Alberta Podcast Network takes shape. You can keep up with the latest on the network at albertapodcastnetwork.com and by following Karen on Twitter at seenandheardyeg. We'll have the links on our website.
Every year, Edmonton Community Foundation hosts an event to thank our donors and all those professionals who volunteer their time to help the foundation reach farther into the community.
This year, our guests were invited to Edmonton Valley Zoo, where our producer Lisa Pruden caught up with a few folks to find out why they're giving back to the community. Let's take a listen.
It's Joe Thompson, and this is my wife, Nancy.
Hi, nice to be here.
Excellent. And so why is it important for you both to give back to the community?
Well, we feel very fortunate. We just felt that it was sort of our duty to return some of the benefits we have received. So
I can't add to that.
I'm Chandra Clark. I'm the incoming chair to the board of directors of the Edmonton Community Foundation. I love the diversity and the scope of the work that we do and the impact that we have in the community.
My name is Dragana Sanchez-Glowicki. I've been involved with ECF for probably the last 20 years. I'm an estate lawyer. I've done a ton of teaching for ECF during the Wills Week. Well, I think it's important to give back to the community. The Edmonton Community Foundation is not just about raising money and giving money, but they help the entire community in not only education and deciding on philanthropy. It's just an incredible resource that too many people don't know about and a lot more people need to find out about.
My name is Jackie Fuga. We actually have a legacy fund in my brother's name through the Edmonton Community Foundation. So it's been there for about 6 years now. He was huge in the community. He was a big, boisterous kid and loved hockey. And so we wanted a way to find kids that wanted to participate in sport and through academics or whatever, and just find a way to give back to them because that's what he would have wanted. So we just wanted to honor him in the best way we knew how.
Okay, my name is Ken Saunders. I have a fund set up for my wife. The monies that are generated go into a education fund for people with disabilities. I feel it's very important because my wife was always involved in community affairs, and employabilities is one that deals with a lot of disadvantaged people.
We were just listening in on our donor appreciation event at Edmonton Valley Zoo. Thanks so much to all of our donors and volunteers for everything you do to help make Edmonton an amazing city to live in.
We're nearing the end of our show, which means...
news time!
First, that special announcement. Hey, Lisa, could we get a drum roll or trumpet or something?
Want to give you a chance to win two free VIP tickets to see George Takei live in Edmonton. We've also devised a plan, or should I say, a contest.
That's right. George Takei will be at the Shaw Conference Center on November 28th for his talk, 80 Years of Wisdom. you can win two VIP tickets that give you preferred seating for the talk and a chance to mingle with George at the VIP reception.
We'll have a random draw for the giveaway. You can enter by tweeting a link to this month's episode or sharing it on Facebook. Now be sure to include the hashtag #TheWellEndowedPodcast.
Yeah, it's going to be a fantastic evening, so start sharing.
Hey, Andrew, do we have any other news?
Yep, we've got granting deadlines to share. Listen close to see if you or anyone you know might be able to apply.
First up are the community scholarships. They range from $1,000 to $4,000. These are for students in financial need from Edmonton or Northern Alberta who have demonstrated community involvement or leadership. The due date to apply is June 15th.
Applications for the Vital Signs grants are due on June 17th. These grants are for programs that seek to improve economic outcomes of newcomers and can be up to $40,000. For more details on the grant and how to apply, be sure to visit our website for the link.
And that brings us to the end of the June edition of the Well Endowed Podcast. Thanks to each of our guests for sharing their time with us, and thanks to all of you for tuning in.
We hope you've enjoyed it. If you did, please be sure to share this episode with your friends and subscribe to us on iTunes and Google Play. We've been your hosts, Andrew Paul.
And Elizabeth Bonkink. Until next time. The Well Endowed Podcast is produced by Edmonton Community Foundation.
And edited by Lisa Pruden.
You can visit our website at wellendowedpodcast.com.
Subscribe to us on iTunes.
And follow us on Twitter at @TheECF.
Our theme music was created by Octavo Productions.
Check them out at octavoproductions.com.
And as always, don't forget to visit Edmonton Community Foundation at ecfoundation.org.
Well endowed.
Da, 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 da.
Please let's get a sound effect.
Yes, please.